Today, I am going to talk about Joseph. I don't know what I was thinking when I chose this passage. This is the last Sunday school story in this series, but it's his story is 14 chapters long. So, what stuck out to me in his story was, like, there's a lot of talk about his vocation and what he did, and he was a manager and Potiphar's things, and he was a shepherd, and eventually he became the second in command in Egypt. And so I just saw that thread, so we'll kind of use the story of Joseph to think about work and our theology of work. But I thought that maybe we should read this book to summarize Joseph's life, in case, just to refamiliarize with it. Now, it's a kid story, so some things are different. But this is called A Boy Who Saved His Family. Actually, it's family. I just added an R. So, here we go. Once there was a boy named Joseph. He was one of 13 children. Their father was Jacob. Their family had lived in the land of Canaan ever since their great-grandfather, Abraham. Jacob owned many animals. His children took care of the sheep and goats. Jacob loved Joseph best of all his sons. He gave him a long coat with long sleeves, and this showed that Joseph was to be the leader. The boy was very proud of his coat. His brothers could see that their father loved Joseph more than any of them, and they hated Joseph because of this. Once Joseph told his brothers, "I dreamed we were tying bundles of wheat, and your bundles bowed down to mine." This made the brothers angry. Another time Joseph told them, "I dreamed that the sun and moon and 11 stars bowed down to me. Do you think we will bow down to you?" The brothers laughed. One day, Joseph was looking for his brothers. "Let's kill the dreamer," they said, when they saw him coming. "No," said the oldest brother, "let's put him in this deep hole." So they took away his new coat and put him in the deep hole. Just then some men rode by. "Would you like to buy a boy?" the brothers called out. "You could sell him in Egypt." "Yes, we will buy him," said the men. "I don't advise that." The brothers put goat's blood on Joseph's coat. When Jacob saw the coat, he cried, "A wild beast has killed my boy," and he was very sad. On his way to Egypt, Joseph cried, "Will I ever see my father again? Why did my brothers do this to me?" Then Joseph thought, "God can make bad things turn out good." And Joseph wasn't so afraid anymore. In Egypt, Joseph was sold to a rich man. He had to work without pay, but his master liked his work, and God was with him. One night, the king of Egypt sent for all his wise men. He said, "I dreamed that I saw 7 fat cows and 7 thin ones. The thin cows ate up the fat ones. Then I saw 7 good ears of wheat and 7 bad ears of wheat. The bad ears ate up the good ones. What does this mean?" But none of the wise men knew. Then one of his servants said, "Joseph knows the meaning of dreams, and the king sent for him at once. Joseph was a grown man now. Joseph explained the dreams. "O king, for 7 years much food will grow, and for 7 years nothing will. Store up food in the good years, then there will be food for the bad years." "You are very wise," the king told Joseph. "Take care of things for me." The king gave Joseph new clothes and the king's ring and carriage. Soon the 7 good years came. Everything grew so that Joseph had to have new barns built to store the wheat. Then came the bad years, but the people could buy food from Joseph. So Joseph's big brothers came too. They bowed way down before him. They did not know he was Joseph, but he knew them. "You were spies," he said. "Oh no, sir," they cried. "We have come only to buy food for our family." "No, you were spies," Joseph said. "Put them in jail," he ordered. After 3 days, the brothers were taken back to Joseph. "Now we are paying for what we did to Joseph," they whispered, afraid. Joseph heard what they said. He felt sorry for them. "I am Joseph, your brother," he cried. "I am not angry with you anymore. God brought me to Egypt to save all of us from hunger." The brothers were so happy. They had long been sorry for what they had done to Joseph. They went to get the whole family. How happy Jacob was. Lord, he cried, you are taking such good care of us. God said, I shall go with you to Egypt. Someday I will bring your family back and give them this land. Jacob and his children moved to Egypt. Joseph cried for joy when he saw his father. The family got sacks of flour and good grassland for their animals, and God was with them. But one day, they would return home. The end. So, I don't know if that resonates with any of what you were taught as a kid, but I thought, now that we've covered the whole story, the whole gamut of Genesis 37 to 50, let me know what have you been taught about Joseph before, and how does this compare or contrast with what you've been taught? Yeah, like, was it a setup? Jacob was trying to cause a stir between the brothers? I don't know. Yes, it just strategically skips over Potiphar's wife, yes. And his jail time. Yeah, it skips a few chapters, for sure. Yeah, they kind of mushed all of that together, but yeah, that Joseph sends them back with food and then silver, and then they come back with Benjamin the second time, and then he hides the thing in Benjamin's sack, and then that's when they get thrown in jail. So yeah, good memory. Yeah, it definitely paints the story as he's a good manager and administrator and leader, but he makes some questionable decisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe it was the Egyptian garb, or maybe they just didn't expect him to be still be alive or something. A couple of the things I was always taught as a kid, one of them I noticed because Stephanie pointed out that skips the Potiphar story. And like in high school, that was a really popular one for youth group, like flee temptation. Don't get messed up in sexual immorality. So that one, and then the faithfulness, I think, with small things. And then he's like promoted gradually. I think those were some of the more popular interpretations of this, of the story. Other thoughts? Does anyone have any observations about how this story really, I guess, is a bridge to the bigger story of Scripture? Yeah, it's really a bridge from their homeland, the Promised Land, and then 400 years later, they're in Egypt. So it does kind of introduce us to why do they end up as slaves in Egypt that Moses had to vindicate or rescue. Another thing that I caught, and I wish we could get like into the story, but you're really going to have to read it for yourself. I'll summarize one of my favorite passages here in a minute. One reason why there's 14 chapters on Joseph's life is because it was so pivotal to the history of Israel. Because he bridges from the patriarchs, where you have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and it's focusing on the family of the chosen people and those individuals. Then you go through Joseph's life, and that ends Genesis, so then you start in Exodus with a nation of Israel. It's not just a family line, but it's, you know, thousands and thousands of, or millions of Israelites. So I think that's an important part of the story. The themes that are in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob's life about family jealousy and strife, those are definitely in here with the brothers selling him, and then chapter 38 is a strange one. You can look at that about Judah and Tamar. This chapter 45 is a really great chapter. That's maybe the climax of Genesis, because there's finally some resolution, that there's some unity and a lot of positive things happening when the brothers are reunited, the family is reunited and saved from their famine. So it brings up a lot of things. And what kept sticking out to me in the text was this idea of vocation, that he's probably the best scriptural example of what a career, a biblical career looks like. We meet him in chapter 37, and he's 17 years old. That's when he gets the coat. And then it follows him through his death at 110 years old. So it's like his whole span of his life, and we see him in these different roles. And so I thought that's what I'm going to highlight today. So let me summarize as best as I can chapter 41, because this, I think, was one of my favorite passages. So it's where he's hearing Pharaoh's dreams and interpreting, which with the kid's book actually does a pretty good job, so I didn't feel the need to reread it. But so he goes before Pharaoh from the prison, and Pharaoh tells him his dream, and he interprets the dream for Pharaoh. And then he says, and now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man in chapter 41, verse 33, to put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh. So Pharaoh's like, well, you can interpret dreams. You have a connection. You have the Spirit of God with you. Who else is more wise and discerning? So you're the man for the job. So he becomes the vizier, the prime minister of Egypt, second in command. And I love that he was used in such a pivotal role. And in verse 56, at the end of chapter 41, it says, when the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe everywhere. So it was all the world, or all of their world, the nations surrounding Egypt. And when I was reading that, I was reminded of the promise to Abraham that through you, I'm going to bless all the nations of the world. And though they're not fully, this isn't the full fulfillment of that, but it is a part of that. It is through Joseph, all of the nations surrounding Egypt survived through a great famine. So I think that's one little hint that maybe people who are integral, more used to the story of Abraham and this being read as one continuous story, would be aware of maybe that hint. It also talks about how the grain is as numerous as the sands of the sea, which was another promise to Abraham that his descendants would be as numerous as the sands of the sea. So some of the same phrases even, I think, helping to bridge that here's where we came from, the line of Abraham, and here's where we're going. We're going to Egypt. So I wanted to talk about the topic of vocation. And there's several reasons for that. If most adults spend half their waking lives in their job or doing work, and there's a statistic that I read this week that most adults are unhappy with their jobs, then it's a good reason to discuss it. I think, as I said before, Joseph's life is the best example in Scripture in this topic of vocation. And tomorrow is Labor Day, so what better weekend to talk about the theology of work? So most of my life, I've had a fuzzy theology of work, so I thought maybe it would be helpful to put some meat on the bones of what is work, what is our calling, our vocation, because not all of you are pastors like me, and some people view only pastors as calling, and I don't think that that's the accurate picture, but that's some of what has been said before, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but a couple things that came to a head for me. A few months ago, I was talking with someone from our church, and I was getting to know him, and I was like, asking about his job, asking about his family, and he was telling me about his job, and he said he'd been there doing the same career path for about 20 years. And I was like, oh, well, you must like it, and you must be really good at it then. And just thinking, oh, that's something people say in conversation. And he said, actually, I hate my job. I'm just buying time until I retire. And I was really sad for him that he'd been doing something for 20 years and maybe it lost its luster, or maybe he never really enjoyed it. He just did it for practical purposes. But for me to think that he's just going to be doing his job for another 10, 20 years that he hates, like, just seemed sad. So I hope that is not the case for very many of you in here. And then a few weeks ago, you might remember, I took time at the, like, 2 minutes during service to pray for teachers that were starting the school year. And I had so many teachers come up to me and say thank you and how much that meant to them and how, like, I felt like I hardly did anything, and there was like this overwhelming response, like on Facebook, and then I got this text from one of the teachers that I wanted to share. One of the teachers said this: "Thank you again for what you said in church today in support of the teachers. You have no idea how much that meant to all of us. It's easy to lose perspective of what the job really means." And I thought, if teachers who are day-to-day pouring into kids and students, it's easy for them to lose perspective, then what is it, how hard is it for other people who are a little detached from direct contact with people, or they're just crunching numbers all day? Or, like, I had a friend in Tulsa that worked for a factory that they made tiny springs, like, that you put in click pins. It's like, what does that mean for him? You know, like, I hope he feels like what he does matters, that it's providing value, that it has significance. And if no one else notices, that at least God does. So there's all these things that kind of came together while I was reading the story of Joseph. I read all 14 chapters, and I just kind of saw this theme, and we don't have time to read it today, so I'd encourage you to take a look at Genesis, the end of Genesis. So all these things kind of came together, and I thought, theology of work. It's a worthy subject. There's a book that Timothy Keller wrote called Every Good Endeavor. And he wrestles with this question of, how does my Christian faith impact my job? What is the purpose of work, and what does God ask of us? Is it to make money? Is it to make money so that you can give it away? Is it to further social justice in the world? Is your primary purpose at your job to be a witness to your colleagues, or to just do competent, skillful, excellent work? Or maybe it's to bring value to others, or to grow in patience and faithfulness, more of an internal purpose. Or to satisfy us and give us purpose, to give us something to do. Or is it to create beauty, goodness, and love? So he highlights all these different voices that people are saying all these things. And some are emphasizing some more than others. Some are saying, the main reason you're at your job is to be a light. You're like an undercover Christian spy, and you're just supposed to be a witness for Jesus and spread the gospel, and that's your whole purpose. The paying thing, yeah, that meets some practical need, but the real reason you're there is to be a light. Or some people would say, I've kind of moved away from some of that evangelism stuff. I think the main thing that you can do with your job is to just be good at it, to do skilled work that God is pleased by committing to your job, to be an expert in your field, and to be committed. And it's like, yeah, evangelism is a good thing, but that doesn't have to happen in your job, that it, you know, it can be separate or whatever. So any of these number of things that people will say, and oftentimes it's, this is the only thing, or this is the main thing. And so I think there's a lot of factors that play into this. So I want to clarify a couple things. Work, I found a definition, and I liked this definition. Work is defined as this: an activity in which one exerts strength or faculties to do or perform something. It's not limited to employee or employer, or it's only a job if you get paid. So some of you get paid for what you do, and some of you don't. Some of you are nurturing your kids or your grandkids, or you're doing repairs, or you're a student. And I feel bad for you if you're a student, because especially in college, you're paying someone else so you can work. And that is kind of terrible. So even though a lot of the quotes that I'll show are framed as like typical jobs, I want you to hear that everybody works in some capacity. Everyone is putting their hand to something. And so frame it that way. Don't discount yourself because you're a stay-at-home parent or because you're retired or you're a student not yet working. So Timothy Keller said this. Then sociologists have noticed a trend that as our perspective of work has changed and our perspective of our role in society has changed, it's impacted a lot of things. So there's Robert Bella had written this book, Habits of the Heart, and the subtitle is Individualism and Commitment in American Life. And he realized, has anyone heard of this author of this book before? Only a few people had in first service. I hadn't heard of him before this, but apparently he's a pretty well-renowned sociologist. He's, you know, been a professor at some Ivy League schools. So he talked about how as our culture has moved progressively toward individualism, individuality, and industrial type work, we've started to detach from some of our old models of thinking. And the more that we become individual, the more we've lost sight of how we fit into the broader picture. And so it's easy, like think of the my friend who makes springs. How does making springs fit into the bigger picture? You know, and all the voices are talking about like it's about the focus is on you and your job and your family and it's kind of hard to tie all these things together. But he noticed in his research that the more we focus on ourselves, the more we're unhappy with our job. And so the more we can see how we fit into the bigger picture, the greater satisfaction that we'll have in what work we do. So I'm hoping that we'll make some headway in that direction. So he said this, to make a real difference, or to maybe a solution to this problem, there would have to be a real appropriation to the idea of vocation or calling, a return in a new way to the idea of work as a contribution to the good of all, and not merely as a means to one's own advancement. So I think us sitting in this room, we understand that there are practical reasons to have jobs and to get paid. But there are so many other reasons. There are so many other reasons why we work. And the more those reasons are about others, the greater satisfaction that we'll have. And I like this quote because it brings up a good question. What is the relationship between our calling, or how we follow Jesus, and our work? I think there's several views. So the first view is seeing work and calling as separate. I kind of hinted at this earlier with there's an old tradition, which I hope eventually dies, but it's still around, that my job as a pastor is spiritual, but anyone else's job is not spiritual. That calling is only about spiritual things. It's about Christian things. And so at church, like, you're part of your calling right now on Sundays. But Monday through Friday, that's just your work. That's just your day job. But I think that has some really negative implications. I think of Joseph, and under this perspective, Joseph's jobs as shepherd, as a manager, and even as the prime minister of Egypt, they're just his work. And they don't intersect with his calling on how he faithfully follows God. What he's called to do with his life is separate. But maybe his role as a dream interpreter, well, that's the spiritual part of his life. But it's only a few verses, so you're discounting all those other contributions that he makes to his family and to the rest of society. So I don't like how this view makes work or what we do seem less meaningful. There's a very narrow definition of what calling is in this thought. Martin Luther said this, mostly against that view. It is pure invention that pope, bishops, priests, and monks are called the spiritual estate, while princes, lords, artisans, and farmers are called the temporal estate. This isn't indeed a piece of deceit and hypocrisy, yet no one need be intimidated by it, and that for this reason. All Christians are truly of the spiritual estate. So I hope that makes sense to you and that you that resonates with you to some degree, that you are part of the spiritual state, that your calling is bigger than just what you do on Sunday mornings. And it, you're definitely included in the spiritual state. It's not just limited to me and Charlie and the rest of the staff. Or some people might even throw in like Christian teachers or Christian counselors or like seminary professors. So another view is this, that work and calling overlap to some degree. That our faith should impact our day-to-day lives, and if half of our lives are spent at work, that is one of the functions of our calling. That is part of what we're called to do. That what we put our energy into matters, and that you can't completely separate our vocation from our spiritual life. So work and calling are pieces that overlap. And I love this that view because I think faith does impact how we work. It impacts our actual work and the style with which we approach the work. So some people will focus on different aspects of this overlap. Some will argue more for an outward expression or some of the outward characteristics of how it overlaps. So that's going back to being your work is a place where you're a light. And you're spreading the gospel, you're being a witness to your colleagues. That's an outward expression of how your faith impacts your work. Or your work is a platform for doing good in the world, for contributing toward a better world, for enabling God's kingdom principles of beauty and love and worth and creativity. And they would also argue that all of work at its core is a way of loving our neighbor, that we can serve others through our work. So I like that this one broadens the definition of calling, and it's not as narrow as the first view, that calling and work have some overlap and that they have some play back and forth. Some people would also say there's the inward side of how our work affects us. So they would say the question is this: how do we allow our work to move us toward the person that God wants us to become? That work is a part of our transformation, of our inner inner character building. So in Joseph's life, him being a faithful shepherd was part of what he was called to do. That faithfulness of character was then recognized, and you can kind of see that theme, that helped him fulfill what part of what he was called to do. That when he was tempted by Potiphar's wife, that he had integrity, and that while he was a slave or a prisoner for 13 years of his life, that hopefully that was an avenue where he grew in patience. So there's like an inward dynamic, and or for his outward dynamic and impact, I think there's a lot of examples of that as well. There's the fact that he saved his family from famine, that he provided grain for such a wide number of people, that he did good. He did a lot of good in his community. He was used by God to feed the nations, and he was used by God to interpret dreams. So there's this tie between work and calling. And how much more meaningful is that when your life as a Christian can funnel through what you're spending 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 hours a week doing? I think it's really important. I know in my own life, I worked with a boy who had autism for 6 years, and it was pretty severe. I don't know how familiar you are with autism, but his name was Frank, and I started helping this family out with Frank as kind of a behavioral aid / Manny / tutor / all these things. So for 6 years, and most of the time I was full time, and I really grew in patience working with him. I mean, you think it takes patience, and it's a test of your character to raise kids who are normally developed. Kids with special needs take a little more patience. They're a little even more of an opportunity to grow in your character. And Christina can attest to this, that there were a lot of nights that I came home very stressed and with a lot of baggage I had to decompress, because it was a tough job, and I think I really did grow. I think God used that as an opportunity to teach me and lessons of kindness and patience. So one of my favorite threads in this zone of ideas comes from qideas.org. Gabe Lyons wrote a book called The Next Christians that you may have heard about. But he identifies 7 different channels of cultural influence. And I find it really intriguing that he basically groups different professions into these 7 different areas. So there's the media component of our culture, that there's arts and entertainment, there's the business world, there's education, there's government, there's the church world, and there's the social sector. And people have jobs in these different areas. And you'll see that the M for media is a different color. And I just pulled this chart straight from their website. So the reason they color it blue is because media is unique, especially in our day and age, where it's the information age. And so all of the different spheres use media as a way of communicating and as information spread. And the church is a different color because the church has a unique role in society and influencing our world for good, because all of you come from, you're putting your efforts toward these different spheres. And so it's really unique, because we have representatives from all these different sectors of society that meet together and converse and build relationship, and we talk about our jobs, and we talk about what does it mean to live with integrity, following Jesus in our world. And so it's a unique thing, because we all come together, and you don't mix engineers and nurses and stay-at-home dads and people that are government officials. Actually, there was someone that was here in First Service that's running for Congress. I don't know if people know that, but anyway, so there's all these different spheres of influence, and we come together. So I find that really intriguing, qideas.org. I also like that it points out that all of these different roles have different styles of doing good in our community and world. Yeah, I'm doing good in my role, and maybe it's easier to connect that to spiritual calling than the guy who makes springs or who crushes stones with a hammer and wonders, how does this connect to my calling? But I think if you see it as just contributing this little piece and you're fitting into the broader context, that's critical. So maybe being faithful at work differs somewhat according to your context. One author says it this way, that the question we should be asking ourselves is this: how, with my existing abilities and opportunities, can I be of greatest service to other people, knowing what I do of God's kingdom and human need? How, with my existing abilities and opportunities, can I be of greatest service to other people, knowing what I do of God's kingdom and human need? And I love that question, because I think it highlights this dynamic that sometimes we feel pressure that our spiritual calling is like very spiritual and doesn't have any connection to what we do. Or calling is seen as this ultimate passion, like I just love what I do. I just live to work, and I'm just making such a big difference. I can't wait to go to work. But if you see it in the context of, here I am, I have these opportunities, I have these skills, how can I do the best job that I can to serve those around me? And I think being successful in that regard is a lot easier than trying to live up to some lofty ideal of, well, I'm never going to be doing what I'm passionate about, or what, you know, it's like what only I can do. Think maybe, hopefully we take steps toward that, but I think maybe there's a greater calling on our lives to be servants, to spread God's love. So that kind of leads to the third perspective. Whereas in option number one, most of what you spend your time on has no spiritual value, option number two adds some things to the equation and says work can be neutral Or it can be a platform where your character is transformed, or it can be a platform where you're making a positive impact on the culture and in our world. That you are a force for good in our kingdom, in our world, spreading the kingdom values, which I know we've talked about before. So I like option two. I think that there are some really good elements, but I think it's missing something, which option three highlights. Option two's weakness is seeing work only as a means to an end. That it only intersects with our calling as Christians if it's used to do this or that. But what if work has value in and of itself? What if work, just doing things, just thinking about things, problem solving, creating, the work that you do is valuable? Even if it doesn't lead to some of those other spiritual components. So in this view, calling is a much broader definition. Calling is seeing yourself as an agent of God in this world, that you're made in the image of God and you're called to some of these things. But part of being made in the image of God is just creating, is working. That from the beginning, God created the rhythms of work and rest, that he himself worked. And so there is importance and value just in working in and of itself as an end, not just as a means to an end. In the movie Chariots of Fire, J.D. Liddell said this to his son. He said, "You can praise God by peeling a spud if you peel it to perfection." And I like the simplicity of that. I think God is pleased when we are good at our jobs, even if that's not for the purpose of someone seeing, wow, you're really great at your job, tell me about Jesus. You know, it doesn't have to be you're good at your job and you're a witness, so it has value. But competence, being excellent and skilled, is part of what we're called to do as Christians. There was some quote, and I ended up cutting it, but now it's in my mind. It said that churches will have in the past talked to an intelligent carpenter, and basically the only thing that required of him is don't get drunk at night, and come to church on Sunday. And that was what was required of him. And this quote, I can't remember who it was even, but this lady said, the first thing the church should be telling him is what his faith requires of him is that he should make good tables. That as an intelligent carpenter, his first role as a Christian, his first requirement is to make good tables. And I liked that. That our work can and should lead to personal transformation and some of the outward implications that it can be used. But even if it doesn't, it still has value. You might recognize this statement that's from our website, since it's one of our directives. Everything. We believe that all of life, food, friends, work, money, pleasure, sleep, is spiritual. We do not fragment our lives. We live with a growing understanding that everything we do relates to God. And I just love that, and I think it's such a great reminder that what you do has value, and work is part of what we're called to do. Even if it's not our greatest passion, that God is pleased when we're diligent and faithful in it. You can see this dynamic of part of our calling as human beings is to create. Not only can you see that through the Genesis narrative at the beginning of this, that sets up the story of Joseph. But being made in God's image and working is part of being fully human. And I think that I've seen people who retire or people who can't work or they're handicapped or they're sick in the hospital and they can't get to their job. Like, there's a sort of frustration or something's missing when you can't put your hand to doing something. Like, we all have this craving to be productive, to do something, to have some significance, some purpose in life. And I think that speaks to why work is part of our calling. I mean, it's just a small part. It's not the whole gamut. But it is part of what we're called to do. Or when the empty nest syndrome starts and your kids move out of your house and you're like, what do I do now with my life? It's called empty nest because there's this feeling of emptiness. Something is missing because for 20 or 30 or 40 years, you nurtured these kids and you poured your heart and soul into them. Now that they're gone, what do? You have to find something to replace that. And hopefully eventually it's grandchildren or being involved in your community or serving at church or doing, you know, handiwork around people's houses and for friends and stuff. But there's that piece that's missing when we're not working, when we're not able to do what God created us to do. So we were created to work, to create, to nurture, to problem solve, to add value to those around us. Dorothy Sayers is a British author, and I don't know much about her. I know she's written some, I think, like mystery type stuff. But she lived during the World War II era and noticed some things. I'm not sure when this quote is taken from, but I just liked how it pulled together so many of these elements that we've been discussing. That work is, or it should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties. The thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God. I don't know how many of you, probably not most of you, aren't feeling like your work, your job, is the full expression of your satisfaction, mind, spirit, and body. But maybe that's because our definition of work is too small. Or maybe that's because our definition of calling is too small. That what if she's saying work, what we do with our lives, should be the full expression of what we're called to. That work isn't just limited to a job. That work is one of many things that we do with our lives that are ways that we impact those around us, that we change, and that we are just thriving and growing as human beings. Colossians 3 says it this way: whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as if you were working for the Lord. And I was reminded of that verse and challenged. And, you know, I think Joseph wasn't perfect, but largely it seems like he had this attitude of, there is purpose to my life. And maybe he was cognizant of, I'm trying my best to be faithful to the God who made me. And maybe that's why he was able to resist the temptation from Potiphar's wife, and maybe he was able to hear God more clearly and interpret those dreams. So if Jesus was your direct supervisor, would that change how you approach your job or the broader things that you're involved with? Would it change the way you view your success? I think it's a good question. Maybe some of you are awesome at what you do, and you're skilled, and you put in the extra time, and you go the extra mile, and you do your best at what you do. And you wonder sometimes if it's worth it because other people are focused on themselves and doing the bare minimum and just trying to get by. And I would encourage you that for this reason and more, it is worth it to put in the extra time, that it is part of our calling. And you may think that no one is looking or noticing, or that people don't care about what you do, but someone, at the very least, is noticing. Someone does care about what you do and is watching, and I think it is worth it. So, hopefully, if anything else, you leave with that little nugget that I don't want you to forget or lose perspective about your job. I want you to see that you are making a difference, either directly through your work, indirectly through your work, or beyond your work. So hopefully that's helpful. And I thought we'd end a little differently, and actually I wanted to get your feedback. So what resonates within you? Maybe you thought, should I change my job? Should I change my role? Change perspective? Or change focus? Maybe that's something. Or I would like to add to that a couple other questions. Are you satisfied with where you are right now? Is there something you want to change? And what is your theology of work? How have you wrestled with this? I was talking with someone after first service that said, they used to want to be a missionary, and they wanted to teach people to plant in poor areas, plant food and grow stuff for a livelihood. And now they work in physical therapy, and she was saying that sometimes she isn't able to connect how she follows Jesus with her day job. So give me some feedback and discuss. I'll leave a few minutes for discussion about this. What's resonated with you in this area? Yeah, good. Thank you for that feedback. Maybe I'll say it for the podcast that she said that she loves her job, which I'm glad that you do, that you find fulfillment in that, and that you do connect it to somewhat that God cares about creation and cares about our bodies, but that it does seem sometimes to be in conflict with other aspects of our spirituality or of our calling as Christians. And I think that is one of the hardest things to navigate about. How much time do you give toward your job? How much time and energy do you give to other things? Because we're called to more than just our job. And so I think, but I'm glad that you also see that it still fits in there. It's not separate zone, you know, but there's some overlap. But yeah. Yeah. I think that brings up an important idea too, because there's also sometimes a tension between, well, I'm working at this job, and someone else mentioned that, this from First Service, that what if you work for a bank and the bank has some moral dealings and some things that maybe you don't disagree with, or it helps people who are immorally funneling funds through the bank. That kind of all rhymed, or had alliteration. Anyway, I'm distracting myself. Funneling funds. That sounds fun. Christina's going to get mad at me for that later. So a guy named Lane earlier said, "What if you're working for a bank or you're working for Arena, and there are people who do concerts that you very much agree with, and then people who do concerts that you very much don't agree with, that there is this tension too." And it doesn't mean that you're still not where you need to be, that maybe that's exactly where you need to be, and you can be a force for good doing excellent work right there. So I think that is a tension that we face. Yeah, I think that really is important. I think that's part of what the fuzziness I've always experienced. That I've always wondered, like, you know, I've been bogged down with certain labels, and then it's like you start putting things outside of these boxes, and then you're feeling less successful or less meaningful when it's just changing perspective to reorient your definition. Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad to hear that. And I think you're totally right. I mean, how simple is it to just listen to somebody's story? Just to listen, because if you take the time to listen to someone, which all of us could do in any profession, it says, you're worth my time, that you have value. And if that's not part of our calling, I think, what is? And you also bring up something, and I'll wrap up with this. I know today I've only skimmed the surface of this subject. There's tons of resources on it. You feel free to talk to me. And there's different definitions of calling and different types of calling. I once wrote a paper in seminary, like four types of calling. And so there, you know, hopefully I was able to broaden your definition or show you different definitions. And if you do have time, go back and read the story of Joseph, because his story in another land, being faithful, trying to do his best to live for God, has been encouraging to so many Christians throughout the ages. And even the Israelites, who, like when Charlie was talking about with Daniel, they were exiles, and yet the story of Joseph was probably an anchor to them, a reminder of what is it like to live in this world, but yet not just be in it for us. What is it like to follow Jesus faithfully and yet have jobs or things that we do to create and nurture? So to close this, I'd like to read a prayer. So would you please stand with me? Humbly in your sight, we come together, Lord. Grant us now the blessing of your presence here. These our hearts are yours. We give them to you, Lord. purify our love to make it like your own. These, our eyes, are yours. We give them to you, Lord. May we always see your world as with your sight. These, our hands, are yours. We give them to you, Lord. Give them strength and skill to do our work for you. These, our feet, are yours. We give them to you, Lord. May we always walk along the path of life with you. These, our tongues, are yours. We give them to you, Lord. May we speak your healing words of life and truth. These, our ears, are yours. We give them to you, Lord. Open them to hear your words of guidance, Lord. Our whole selves are yours. We give them to you, Lord. Take us now and keep us yours forevermore. Amen.